Hey everyone, this is Dr. Cheryl Stellman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. It's great having you join me today. And as always, this is a great opportunity for us to have some wonderful conversations, to really look into some issues in greater depth. And as you know, my whole focus is about empowering you with truthful information so you can get the insight and the knowledge to make informed decisions possible. So today is an interesting day. And first of all, I want to congratulate everyone on making it through the holidays. I've had a great series on my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, guiding you how to survive the holidays, how to survive the imbibing of alcohol, the imbibing of carbohydrates, sugar, the stress. And we're not over with the holidays yet. So if you want to keep up with some of these tips, then I recommend you get back onto my Facebook page and get some practical solutions there. You know, if you know the way, if you have the steps, if you've been given the keys, you can survive all of these times and have a great time, but not have to suffer the consequences. The holidays are always challenging because we tend to enjoy the very things that challenge our immune system, that adds more stress to our bodies, that makes us more vulnerable to colds and flus and emotional ups and downs. So what we want to do is make the most of this time of these wonderful gatherings and parties and family experiences and celebrations, but we want to come through it feeling better than ever, not having to find ourselves dealing with a cold, a flu. Often that happens this time of year because our immune systems get a little compromised and run down from our excessive indulgences. So that's what I want to do for everybody, is keep you healthy, keep you strong, and hopefully you'll come through and begin the new year with a greater commitment to your health and well-being. And the other thing I want to say is that this is a season, and the new year is always an opportunity to begin something new, to step into new energies, a new perception. There's something about setting the clock at the beginning again. January 1st is a trigger in our conscious and unconscious mind to get things happening anew. So this is a really good opportunity for you to take some time to be quiet. The thing I love about winter, to be honest, is that it is a time that allows us to sit back and reflect. In fact, winter is the time of hibernation. We see it around us in nature. We see it with the animals that have gone into hibernation. All the trees have withdrawn their energies into their roots, and we are also in that hibernating mode. So this is a great opportunity to spend some time with yourself. I live in a wonderful little condo, but it does not have a fireplace, and I so love fireplaces. So what I did this year, I discovered that for $79, I could buy an imitation fireplace that looks like a little cast iron fireplace. It has a little heating element on the bottom, but the thing I love about it, it opens up and has the flames. It looks like there's a real fire going on inside. So now I can have my adorable little cozy condo that I could have a fireplace going and just enjoy that energy and feeling of a fireplace and the warmth, because it has a little heater there too. So these are great tools, and for me it's really comforting, and I just use my winter time to get a little more inward and to set my intentions, my goals, my dreams for the new year. Winter, especially deep winter, which we are into now, is about getting into the dreaming state. So that is what I encourage you to do. Don't get too externalized. This really is an inner time of the year to be warm, to be quiet, to get enough sleep, and to let your dreams begin. to reveal themselves because they will manifest in the spring when the energies are up and out and flowing. So have a little journal, write down your goals, write down your dreams, and don't put any restrictions, no holds barred, just open to all possibilities. So speaking of opening to all possibilities, let's explore the topic at hand today. We are all concerned about the growing epidemic of dementia and Alzheimer's disease in our culture, actually around the world. So we're going to be exploring this topic. We're going to be looking at the challenges to our memories. If some of you already noticing you have a little, you know, glitches in your memory, a little few gaps showing up, those names disappear, that thought on the tip of the tongue you just can't quite get to. Or if you are concerned with friends and relatives or a history of people who might have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, this is the show you want to listen to. We're going to be going through the gamut. And most importantly, we're going to be sharing how to preserve your memory and prevent Alzheimer's disease naturally. And to guide us through this journey and gain the insight and the strategies, I have a very special guest today. And he is Dr. Richard Isaacson. He is a Harvard-trained neurologist, currently serving as an associate professor of clinical neurology, vice chair of education, and education director of the McKnight Brain Institute in the Department of Neurology at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. And Dr. Isaacson now specializes exclusively in Alzheimer's disease, mid-cognitive impairment, age-related memory loss, and other cognitive impairments. So he's good for all of us. And he also is the author, he's the co-author with Dr. Christopher Ochner of his latest book, The Alzheimer's Diet, a step-by-step nutritional approach for memory loss, prevention, and treatment. So it's a pleasure to welcome you, Dr. Isaacson, to the show today.
Hey, Cheryl. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate that you're spreading the word and helping to inform your listeners. It's great.
Well, I noticed your practice covers about every single person listening in on the show and then some.
Absolutely. Well, we try. Equal opportunity.
You know, I have to say, I was preparing for our interview, so I took your book down to my favorite little Starbucks coffee shop where I have my brain-enhancing one cup of coffee a day. And I sat there, and I was, you know, going through the book, and then I packed everything up and left, headed for my car, and I walked out, and I realized I forgot my purse. So I'm wondering, did something happen to me when I read your book?
that's a really great point, and I'm glad you bring that up, because some aspects of memory, it is completely normal to forget things here and there, and especially, you know, I'll give you the brain basis about why you may have forgotten that. You were so excited about reading this new and fun book, and you learned all this great stuff. You were so excited you couldn't even contain yourself. And because of the excitement, your attention wasn't as able to focus on the normal things that were going on, because there was lots of stuff going on. There was the music at the Starbucks, you were drinking your coffee, you were reading this new and cool book called The Alzheimer's Diet. I'm trying to, you know, cheap plug there. But basically, you basically had a lot of things going on, and memory loss can be due to several things. And as we talked about, you know, as you mentioned before, Alzheimer's disease is a progressive neurological disorder where you lose not just the problems with memory, but you forget a whole host of things, how to take care of the bills and how to take care of yourself, as well as other things like anxiety and agitation, even depression. When it comes to the thing that happened to you, you just had a lot of things going on, and you were reading and you weren't maybe paying attention to some things, and that's completely normal for age, and that would be really due to inattention or age-related cognitive change.
Oh, I'm so relieved. I thought I might have caught something by reading your book, you know.
I hope they were sterile when they came out of the plant, but I will check on that.
Anyway, I just thought I had to tell you that was so funny.
it's a great
anyway,
story.
You know, since we have you here, I'd really like us to explore this really important topic, and there's a spectrum that we're going to be looking at, from the concern that people have of sometimes losing that word, right? And which, in your book, you talk about is a normal part of aging. But I just hate to accept anything as a normal part of aging. I would like to see it as some some deficiency or some stress, something that is occurring, so we can maintain all our functions optimally. I may be optimistic, I may be Pollyanna about it, but I'd like to hold that thought as I am moving on in my years myself. And then I'd like us to get into some of the greatest concerns that we have, because Alzheimer's is an epidemic. I mean, the statistics in the next 20, 30 years is pretty shocking. So why don't we start by just looking at some of those statistics?
Sure. So, I mean, Alzheimer's disease is currently the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. And when it comes to numbers, the numbers are completely striking. Currently, there's 5.4 million Americans in the United States that have Alzheimer's disease. And the problem is that probably more than half of those individuals aren't even diagnosed. People think that, oh, you know, grandma, it's okay. She's just forgetting things. That's just normal. And, oh, yeah, she can't take care of herself. And, you know, that's normal. Well, that's not true in my opinion. That's really more consistent with the pathologic process or the disease called Alzheimer's disease. You really hit on an important point before, and you hit on that, you know, I don't want to accept that, you know, as I age, it's normal for my memory to change. And, you know, I completely agree with you. When I was in medical school, I was taught that it's normal for people's memory to change as they age. And actually, the condition was benign forgetfulness of memory, of aging. And that basically means, oh, it's a good thing. It's not a big deal. It's just normal. I completely disagree. And I think where the research is going, and actually the McKnight Brain Institute at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine is actually part of my research, focuses on the differences between age-related memory loss versus normal memory versus Alzheimer's disease. So the take-home point here is that I don't believe that we truly should age in a negative way when it comes to memory. But I just believe that we just haven't figured out all the ways to diagnose and to really determine whether it may be benign or it may just be something more insidious that hasn't really declared itself yet.
So before we get into Alzheimer's, I think we'll save that to the second half of the show, because that needs a lot of discussion. So the first half of the show, I really would like you to help us understand all the factors that are compromising optimal functioning of our brain. And, of course, we're going to be looking at diet and stress and being overweight. I mean, these are things that are going on in our culture and our society that many people, unbeknownst to them, are actually impairing many functions of our body, including our brain's ability to get the right communication happening. So can we go through some of those factors? Because you talk about them in your book, and we can start with perhaps, because I've looked at this book and I've numbered things here because I was so excited about reading your book, inflammation. Let's talk about inflammation and what causes inflammation in the brain and the consequences of inflammation in our brain.
That's a really great question. And I think research has been showing us over this past several years and, of course, several decades that there's a variety of reasons why the brain may lose function over time and why it may not function as optimally. Just like we age in our bodies, we also age in our brains. And one aspect that you touched on that's really, I think, about the crux of the matter is inflammation. Inflammation in the body is different than inflammation in the brain. And one thing that, and when it comes to diet specifically, there are things that we do every day, and that's we eat. And there are very specific types of foods that we eat that can, you know, maybe not really cause, you know, terrible trouble in the body, you know, unless you have bad habits over a long period of time, but can actually have, I don't want to say wreak havoc, but really really cause a lot of problems over time in the brain, and that's inflammation. I'll give you a quick example. When you eat different types of, there's good carbohydrates and there's bad carbohydrates, but when you eat the bad carbohydrates, sugar, and sugar, you know, the high fructose corn syrup that's in a lot of the sodas nowadays, things that really cause a spike in insulin. Insulin is basically a hormone or a chemical that's released by the pancreas. Basically, it's an organ in the body that basically breaks down sugar or is really there to help metabolize or deal with the sugar that a person eats. Now, when it comes to the brain, insulin doesn't break down sugar in the brain, but what insulin does in the brain is it actually can cause inflammation. And there's a lot of different reasons why there can be inflammation or inflammatory processes in the brain. But when it comes to the insulin inflammation hypothesis, this is really underscores why the carbohydrate connection may really be causative or at least contributive in terms of brain aging as well as potentially Alzheimer's disease.
So do you see this increase in dementia issues, memory issues, and then the other end, that more chronic condition of deterioration of Alzheimer's, directly related to the high intake of carbohydrates in our society?
So I think so, but let me give you a quick overview. The number one reason that someone develops Alzheimer's in terms of a risk factor, or the number one reason that anyone changes in terms of their memory or their thinking skills, is going to be age. So there could be a variety of reasons. Number one, we have an aging population. You know, last year the baby boomers started turning 65 for the first time. So what I consider is, even though age is the number one risk factor for Alzheimer's disease and other cognitive changes, there has to be something else too, because, for example, is it the changing diet? You know, the Western style diet versus other diets in other areas. The Western style diet, in my opinion, based on very specific data and epidemiological data, this is not hardcore research studies that prove it definitively, but I believe that in addition to the aging of our population, that the dietary changes in the Western Hemisphere, especially in the United States, is definitely part of the reason why we've had this really explosion of cases. Now, again, there could be several other reasons. Number one, improved ability to make a diagnosis. We have more sophisticated tests now. We have better MRI scans and other cool new imaging studies that are coming out in the future. But if I had to put a pin on one thing, I would say it's a combination of the aging of our population plus the dietary changes.
Well, then let's talk about the role of heavy metals and mercury as a source of inflammation and just a toxic influence in the brain, because that must also play a major role.
Right, so that's a really good point. There's a lot of information out there about mercury and aluminum, and the difficulty when it comes to really definitively, proving these things is that it's really hard to, do a study or basically, find a relationship where, we're going to give half the people mercury and we're going to give the rest of the people nothing, or maybe we'll give half the people too much aluminum. You know, that's unethical research. So the problem with a lot of the research in these areas is that it's hard to 110% definitively prove anything about, whether it's carbohydrates or age or mercury or aluminum. But I think when you look at something called epidemiological data or population-based data, I think that's when there's much more of a link that we definitely need to try to figure out and uncover.
You know, when I was looking at your book, you were talking about risk factors, and you talked about the APOE4. I do nutritional genomic testing, so that's one of the groups of gene types that we look at, and the broad categories of people, and that's the type that I see in my testing that tend to hold onto or bind heavy metals, and there's always a correlation with a greater increased incidence or risk for Alzheimer's disease if you are the type that binds heavy metals. So I noticed that was as a risk factor. Do you want to comment a little further about that?
Right. So I think when it comes to the genes and when it comes to using the genetic code to really be able to make not just diagnostic decisions but also treatment-based decisions, this is an area called nutrigenomics or pharmacogenomics. I think the field of science is a field that is growing. I think there is a lot of data that supports these aspects. Although I think, just to be really frank, I think much more research needs to be done about all of this. I think we've made a lot of progress, but I just don't, I don't know. I think that the science is there, but in order to, fully figure out, based on which person's genes have what should we doing, what types of things should we eat, I think we've made progress, but I think we definitely need more research to be done.
But if somebody does have that gene type or is prone to hold on to heavy metals, you would want them to consider doing some form of detoxing or chelating of those metals, as it can't hurt anyway, right?
Right. I think you know, it's, you know, there's no, you know, just like I put patients on a healthy diet, there's no, the FDA is never going to say it is, you know, it's FDA approved to eat green leafy vegetables to help your memory. I don't think that we have, of course, anything that is safe that could possibly help with, whether, you know, regardless if it's chelation or whether it's avoiding heavy metals or whether it's, you know, using different antiperspirants, there's so much that we can do that is generally safe. The problem is that, you know, the way our society works is that it's very difficult to, you know, have, you know, the government or the FDA or whatever, you know, support recommendations like this. So in my clinical practice, even though I use the FDA-approved drugs, I use several things that are grounded in scientific evidence and that are also balanced in safety. And, you know, for example, with chelation, there was a recent study, in heart disease that actually, you know, for the first time actually was a very well-funded, you know, rigorous study that needs to be, you know, repeated because it was only one study, but they are finding links with chelation, for example, with heart disease. Those studies have not yet been done in Alzheimer's disease, but again, it's all about a balance, and if there's something that could be relatively safe and possibly help, or theoretically definitely help, then it's something that I would consider in my practice.
Okay. I don't want to go any further in that direction. So, well, you know, so many things could be said waiting for the FDA to approve anything. A lot of people could be suffering until that happens, so we know that. But, you know, I'm a naturopathic doctor. I can do things a little bit different, give me a little more latitude.
I understand. You know, and I believe me, as you've read in the book, you know, I use FDA-approved drugs, but that is only one very small part of the answer. I believe that, you know, this disease, I mean, this is a very complicated disease, and I think all diseases are quite complicated. You have to, you know, I don't know if it's thinking outside the box or making the box bigger. I just think that, you know, as physicians, we're just kind of, you know, unfortunately pushed down a little bit, and, you know, there's some people have some restrictions placed on them. When it comes to me, believe me, if it's safe and may work, I use it with my patients.
Well, you know, I really acknowledge you for that, because the, you know, the ability to have an open mind and certainly incorporate diet, nutrition, lifestyle, you know, it can only help. So good for you. So let's go back to the inflammation component, because you're talking about one of the things we can do is to make sure we're taking adequate omega-3 fatty acids in our diet, or the fish oils or krill oil.
Absolutely. So when it comes to the omega-3s, I think there has really been an explosion of data about omega-3s. And, you know, we can go in different directions with this, whether it's healthy fats versus unhealthy fats and better fats versus, you know, other ones. But when it comes to omega-3 fatty acids really need to be not just considered, but really a part of the overall comprehensive treatment, not just for Alzheimer's disease or memory loss prevention or Alzheimer's prevention or whatever it is, but I think a lot of diseases, from heart disease to, you know, diabetes, things like that. We talked earlier about inflammation, and, you know, omega-3s, you know, probably work for a variety of different reasons, but I think, again, inflammation and attenuating inflammation and its effect on inflammation is something that how the omega-3s are most likely definitely work. I think the omega-3s, over the last probably 5 years or so, we now have rigorous scientific evidence, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials that show omega-3s not just work theoretically, but they definitely work in terms of clinical practice. And again, like we talked about with genetics, certain people with certain genes may preferentially respond more so to the omega-3s, and I think that's something that we're learning, and I think that more research, of course, needs to be done.
And, of course, reducing things that are generating inflammation, not only taking supplements or fish oil products that can support anti-inflammatory reactions, but stop the sugars and the carbs that are pro-inflammatory as well. So reduce the causes and then support with nutrition.
Absolutely.
And then you also, another risk factor that can impact memory is the issue of blood flow to the brain. So can you talk a little bit about what impairs blood flow to the brain?
Sure. So I think over time, when as we age and as we accumulate not just inflammation, but also, you know, from, you know, people, for example, that smoke or have high blood pressure or high cholesterol or diabetes, we basically have a condition that is basically called atherosclerosis in the brain, or hardening of the arteries, which is also commonly known as. Basically, there's a process that happens within the blood vessel walls, and I can use big words or small words. I'll just say it's hardening of the arteries, and basically the blood flow in the brain, the smallest arteries, basically the blood just doesn't get to the right places as it should. So I think due to a combination of a variety of something called vascular risk factors, or basically problems that like diabetes, cholesterol, and high blood pressure, over time, when they're not adequately treated, and in addition, when the person doesn't have really an adequate diet, that will combined basically reduce overall blood flow to the brain.
Now, does obesity reduce blood flow to the brain?
Ooh, does obesity reduce blood flow to the brain? That is that's a tough question. If my co-author, Chris Ochner, Dr. Ochner, is actually an obesity specialist, he may be the better person to answer that question.
Oh, interesting. But right.
Let me, if I can use some deductive reasoning skills there, I don't know that obesity in itself would clearly reduce blood flow to the brain. However, the reasons that someone is obese usually is because of, well, there's a variety of reasons, but it could be metabolic syndrome, it could be a sedentary lifestyle, it could be an unhealthy diet. So I would say that most of the risk factors that are associated, or cofactors that are associated with obesity, that probably will over time reduce blood flow to the brain.
You know, I came across a study that I found really fascinating, and that had to do with people who are overweight and obese, and they had their brain volume was shrinking and their brain was aging. I think someone who was overweight, their brain aged somewhere like, you know, 8 to 10 years beyond their normal age, and if you were obese, it was 15 years older.
Yep.
So that would have to, in some way, compromise the ability of the brain to function optimally.
Absolutely. And in these studies, it's what they try to do is they try to figure out, is it the obesity, or is it the blood pressure, is it the diabetes? And in that study, they probably tried to control for other things, and they tried to specifically look at obesity. In terms of the research out there, I would say obesity may be an independent risk factor, and actually I think it now is proven. The other thing is, even overall caloric intake, which is strictly tied to obesity, there was a study that was published this year in 2012, probably one of the most interesting studies published this year in the field of memory loss and Alzheimer's, that showed that patients that basically ate less than 2,100 calories per day were at a much lower risk of developing memory loss or Alzheimer's disease than patients that had between 2,100 and 2,600 calories a day, something like that, or even above 2,600 calories, roughly an estimate of a number. And those patients had a much higher risk of having Alzheimer's disease and brain aging. So I think obesity is, as I think, a big part of it, but I think all of the different risk factors that are involved are probably related.
And they are all related. I mean, being obese means you are creating more inflammatory chemicals, so you're generating inflammation that way as well. I mean, you can't just, I know, have one causative factor, because there are many things creating this perfect storm that's impairing our brain.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's really, I guess, the essence of the thing that's called the metabolic syndrome, which when I was in medical school, there was no metabolic syndrome. But now what we're realizing is that, imagine that, they're all truly related. You don't just have obesity, or you don't just have a big belly. You also have other things that are all really related to each other.
Well, this is a good moment to stop so we can take a break. And then when we get back, my conversation with Dr. Richard Isaacson, who is the author of The Alzheimer's Diet, will continue. So stay tuned, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and you are listening to What Women Must Know. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know, and today we're talking with Dr. Richard Isaacson, who is the author of The Alzheimer's Diet, a step-by-step nutritional approach for memory loss, prevention, and treatment. And Dr. Isaacson, we were talking about some of the things that impact our memory or our brain's capacity to function optimally. Is there anything we need to just touch on before we move on to the really important subject of Alzheimer's disease?
Well, I think memory is complicated. It's not just, do you remember something? I think really your situation and your surroundings, as we touched on before, you may not have a memory problem if you just have a lot of things going on. For example, the kids are screaming or the dog is barking, or you're on your cell phone, you're driving, and you shouldn't be doing that, you're texting. And, when you have a lot of things going on, the brain can only focus on so many things at a time. And in this technological savvy world we have, I think there's a lot of distractions out there. So I think that's one thing. I think another thing is that when it comes to memory loss, it may not be something like Alzheimer's disease, and it may be something, like a medical problem, like a thyroid problem or a B vitamin deficiency or even an infectious disease. So there's a lot of things out there that can contribute, and maybe it's something else, even like depression. Someone who is depressed and not really feeling that great about things or about themselves or their life may not be able to focus on things, and again, that's more of an attention problem than a memory problem. So I think anytime that you may suspect a memory problem, get educated, get informed, see someone about it, get evaluated, and it's really nothing to be ashamed of. I have four family members in my family that have memory problems, Alzheimer's disease. Each one has progressed to Alzheimer's disease. So I think the take-home point here is that there's a lot of things that we can do now. There's a lot of ways to diagnose, and especially there's so much we can do in terms of treatment.
So some lapse of memory is normal. Maybe it's because we need to put some more omega-3s in our diet. Maybe we need to reduce the stress. Maybe we need to put a little exercise. I mean, the first step is to look and see what things we might want to explore in our lifestyle that may be missing. When is this memory loss or lapses of memory become a condition that we need to pay a little bit more attention to or perhaps be a bit more concerned about?
Right, and that's really the key question. Any time that someone's memory or thinking skills basically leads them to not be able to do the normal things that they would have been able to do if they weren't having a memory problem, or that they were able to do in the past, or really a change from their baseline, that's really when the red flags go up and things may get more worrisome. Additionally, any time that memory problems are also in combination with a change in behavior, agitation, depression, irritability, or even sleep problems, these are things where something more serious than a typical scatterbrain memory loss may be at play, and that's something where you would want to get evaluated for Alzheimer's disease.
One time I had to do an article on dementia and B12, so I learned something really interesting when I delved into that topic. B12 deficiency, which is a really common deficiency in people, especially as we get older, can actually cause dementia. And can be easily remedied if we increase B12 levels. So I think it's really important for people to understand that if we are experiencing symptoms that affect our memory and are repeating ourselves, that we need to first look at some of the obvious things that may be factors impacting our memory, like B12. Do you agree with that?
Oh, 110%. I think it's imperative to make sure that, the simple things aren't being overlooked. B12 is, an essential vitamin, and not just is it essential, it is in so many people just not taken an adequate amount or dose. I think a part of the problem is that as we age, I think really over the age of 50, the body just doesn't absorb B12 or B vitamins in general as much as it used to when people were a little bit younger. So what do you do in a situation like this? Well, number one, you can have B vitamin rich foods. Number two, you can take a B vitamin in terms of a pill form, and I actually, not just myself, but also for memory loss prevention, I do advocate for a B-complex vitamin with folic acid, B6 and B12 at the highest doses that you can find. But the third point is that, it may get to the point where even if you're doing that, you're having a healthy diet and you're taking B vitamins via vitamin pills or in a pill or capsule form, that actually, because of the absorption issue as we age or even due to different medical issues, the body may not be able to absorb the B that you're taking in, so those people may benefit from B12 injections. And I think that's really a good overview about how I envision or how I view the B12 story.
Yes, because especially if people are taking proton pump inhibitors and taking the propyl pill, which suppresses stomach acid, which suppresses the body's ability to absorb B12, becomes a really big problem for people.
Exactly. You got it.
Yeah. Okay, so we can rule out B12 deficiencies, maybe look at vitamin D3 levels as well.
Definitely, yeah. You hit the nail again right on the head. Vitamin D, there's a lot of research that's been shown. I mean, vitamin D is not just good for memory. It's good for so many different things. In some ways, really, basically all older Americans should probably be on B-complex vitamin and vitamin D supplements, as proved by their treating a practitioner. But really, when it comes to vitamin D, I think vitamin D3, I think, in Florida, I live in Miami. I would say in recent studies, over 60% of people living in Miami are vitamin D deficient. And you wouldn't expect that with the sunshine and with food and things like that. Vitamin D deficiency is so under-recognized, it's under-treated, and I do believe that there's significant evidence that shows that really having a deficient vitamin D can actually not just spur on other issues, but also memory loss. So I do advocate for vitamin D-rich foods as well as taking a vitamin D supplement, which I do take myself.
One more thing I just wanted to ask you. Before we really delve into the Alzheimer's issue, I had a guest, a medical doctor, on my show a while back, and he was he shared his own personal experience of what occurred when he was on statin drugs, and he had amnesia, he had memory loss, which was considered a form of dementia. And he's really concerned that for some people, the statin drugs may cause this global amnesia condition. Okay, what are your thoughts about that?
Right. So I think you'll read about this and you'll hear about this, and I've had patients that I've seen for very specific things. I think that statin drugs there has definitely been reports, I think, time and time again about memory loss and cognitive impairment. I think each patient is really an individual, and you really need to look at why is someone prescribed any different type of drug that they're being treated on. If they have very high cholesterol and they're at risk for a heart attack and they have a bad family history, you have to look in terms of the risks and benefits. Of course, there are risks to all drugs out there. Most drugs have a lot of side effects, unfortunately, and you always have to balance the risk versus benefit. I think if someone does have very significant family history and heart disease, I think it makes sense to at least try the person on these statins. However, if someone is exhibiting problems with memory loss or other cognitive impairments or fogginess or amnesia, then that's something that there's got to be other ways to address the cholesterol issue. I think especially diet, exercise, and some natural things like we talked about. The supplement omega-3 fatty acids is something that's been proven now to also help with cholesterol. So I think there's no one-size-fits-all approach, but I think definitely there's been time and time again reports of cognitive impairment due to statin.
So do you think if a person is having some of these symptoms show up and they go to a specialist, that most specialists will address some of the things that you and I talked about, the B12 issue, the D3 issue, maybe if they're on other medications that could impair their cognitive functioning?
We hope that's the case.
I was going to say, is this where patients really need to get educated?
Patients always need to get educated, especially about this stuff. The problem is that I'm very fortunate. I'm in an academic research center. I have grants to support myself, and I spend every single patient that I see. I'm very fortunate. I spend an hour per patient. If I was in the private practice setting or in a clinic and in some other place, I would have between 10 and 15, maybe 20 minutes to spend with the patient. So because of the way the healthcare system is now, and we won't get into the politics and all that kind of thing, but I think patients and their caregivers and really people in general need to take ownership and really need to get educated and informed about their medical conditions. They need to read what's out there. You know, yes, there's a lot of good information on the internet. There's also some not as good information on the internet. So the take-home point is find a reliable source. See a treating practitioner. See a physician. But really, you know, take charge of your own of each person's own health and wellness. I think that's really imperative. All doctors, aside from not just having, you know, time, unfortunately, a lot of doctors just aren't trained on these types of things. And also, when they did train, the science just wasn't there yet, or the field just hadn't progressed. It was normal for someone, quote-unquote normal, for someone to have memory loss as they were 75 or 65 or 85 or whatever age. So I think it's really imperative that you know, not just trying to find a good person who's recommended well, but that patients and caregivers get informed.
Okay, that was a great response. I appreciate that. So let's get into the nitty-gritties about Alzheimer's. As a researcher, I'm sure you're up with the latest information. What is really going on in the brain of a person who's diagnosed with Alzheimer's?
That's not just a million-dollar question. That's a billion-dollar question. I can tell you that this answer has meandered in my brain. You know, in medical school, I was taught one thing. After I finished all my residency training, I left Boston thinking I knew everything, and then finally realizing, wow, you know what? I don't know anything at all. I don't really think that we truly 100% know why Alzheimer's disease happens. I think that it's probably multifactorial. I think several things are going on. If you want to use the different buzzwords, we use the buzzword of amyloid and tau. These are basically bad proteins that accumulate in the brain cells of Alzheimer's patients. But to be really frank, I don't think anyone truly knows why this disease happens. It's not just genetic. It's partially environmental. There's a lot of things going on. You know, there's a saying out there, once you've seen one patient with Alzheimer's, you've seen one patient with Alzheimer's. I think Alzheimer's is a very, very heterogeneous condition. There's good forms of Alzheimer's, if you can say that, or really better forms of Alzheimer's versus worse forms of Alzheimer's. And I think it's a very, very, very complicated disease.
But what actually goes on? What's impaired in a person's brain who has Alzheimer's? I mean, can you generalize this to...
Yeah, I mean, in general, 20 to 30 years before symptoms start. So this is someone who hasn't even had any memory trouble yet, but if you look at their brain, how their brain functions, a functional image, which is basically shows, you know, for example, how much the primary fuel that the brain uses or the primary energy source that the brain uses is going to be glucose or sugar. So sugar is basically metabolized by the brain. If you look at the brain in those at risk who are going to develop Alzheimer's, they can't use sugar. Basically, the brain doesn't light up. It's not like a pretty picture like you'd normally see. So even decades before, there's something abnormal with metabolism or brain energy usage in the brain. And, you know, why is this? I have my own theories. People used to say it's because of this amyloid protein that gets deposited, and that's the cause of Alzheimer's. I don't really agree with the amyloid hypothesis primarily as a cause of Alzheimer's. What I would say, I think it's, you know, diet-related, but not just diet-related. I think there may also be some sort of cellular problem where just the cells can't use sugar and needs to rely on other fuels. But to be really frank, I'm speculating, and I don't think anyone knows 100% the answer to this question.
But something is going on that didn't exist 50 or 100 years ago, because even though there may be better, you know, forms of diagnosis and better technologies to assess, but truly we're seeing a growing incidence that never really existed before when we really look into the brain. So, and as we said earlier, it's a bit of a perfect storm going on between the dietary model, what we're generally our population is eating and has been eating for a long time, now since birth for some people, and the environmental exposures, the heavy metal exposures, the stress levels. I mean, and then there's the head injuries. So let's talk a bit about head injuries. Is there a correlation between head trauma and Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I care for two retired NFL football players that both one mother and one father had Alzheimer's disease. The one person's mom had Alzheimer's probably in the late 70s. The other one, his dad actually had Alzheimer's in the early 70s. And both of these retired NFL football players who, I mean, they played football their entire life, and they had a lot of head trauma and a lot of concussions. And back then, if you had a concussion, they pushed you right up on the field. And the take-home point with this is that, yes, if you have had multiple head trauma, and if you have actually one of those genes, and the gene that we talked about before is APOE4, if you have one copy or more of the APOE4 gene, you get one gene from mom, one gene from dad, if you have one or more copies of the APOE4 gene, and you have multiple head traumas or head injuries or concussions or whatever it is, especially if you lose consciousness, that is a specific type of patient that will have or develop Alzheimer's disease much earlier than they would have if they would have, either way. And there is definitely a correlation between genetics and concussion and Alzheimer's disease.
And when we talk about brain injury, would you include whiplash if you are in a car accident?
Yes, I think so. Whiplash, there's when it comes to the brain, when someone thinks of the term whiplash, they think, oh, you know, my neck hurts or something like that. Well, yeah, of course your neck's going to hurt because the muscles and the spine were hit and it kind of went, you know, rippled back and forth. But when it comes to the brain is also in the head. And if you slam on your brakes, your brain is going to hit one side of your brain and then it's basically going to, one side of your skull and then backlash, you know, the other side of the skull. And that would be something that would be more along the lines of something called a coup and contra coup injury. The coup and contra coup injuries, which is kind of a back and forth trauma of the brain, can absolutely attribute to dementia or Alzheimer's disease, and it's something that's actually coming up much more into the mainstream because people are realizing that returning war veterans who are pretty young and shouldn't have Alzheimer's or shouldn't have memory loss are coming back, and after they've had a traumatic brain injury, to have cognitive impairment.
It's pretty scary. What would you recommend if somebody had a brain injury? What kind of supplements or nutritional support, or what should they do if they want to support their brain in recovering?
Yeah, so I think living a good, healthy lifestyle is really the most important thing. Exercise on a regular basis, staying engaged in life, taking classes, trying to use the brain and not just let it sit there. Also, a healthy diet rich in omega-3s, high in antioxidants, green leafy vegetables. If it's green, eat it. Low carbohydrates, high in the healthy saturated fats like olive oil and avocado, for example. Caffeine in moderation earlier in the day. These are all specific, chocolate. Dark cocoa powder, for example, has very high amounts of cocoa flavanols or basically strong antioxidants. These are some of the real basic tenets of healthy eating that I truly believe will slow down brain aging and will also help in someone with traumatic brain injury. There's also studies that are ongoing now. Different people have different specific reasons about why their memories don't work after a traumatic brain injury. It may depend on where the injury is in the brain. So different types of therapy may need to focus specifically, but I think those are probably the best our best general recommendations.
Well, that's great. In the few minutes we have left, what else do we need to touch upon, Dr. Isaacson, that we haven't mentioned that you think is important?
Yeah, well, I think when it comes to Alzheimer's disease, there's no one magic bullet, there's no one magic pill, there's no one magic patch. But, the way that I look at this is it's kind of like, we talked about the war veterans, it's kind of like fighting a war. You can send in the ground attack, but you really need everything. You need the Air Force and the Coast Guard and the Navy and the Marines and the Special Forces. When it comes to Alzheimer's disease, it's such a complicated disease. And, physicians and practitioners out there need to realize that you need to hit this disease from every angle. A healthy lifestyle, diet, and exercise. And very specific types of foods, fish that are high in omega-3s, for example, lean meats, low-fat yogurts. There's just so much that we need to try. Berries, strawberries and blueberries have very high antioxidants as well, and the research supports these. But there's much more. There's very specific types of vitamins. We talked about the B-complex vitamins. We talked about vitamin D, possibly getting your levels checked and monitored. Something we didn't touch upon yet is curcumin. curcumin or turmeric has very, very high antioxidant properties, and it's been really shown that people that have very high diets in curcumin or the spice, the Indian spice curry, can actually really help to protect the brain. So the take-home point here is that there's no one-size-fits-all approach other than really hitting this from every single angle, making sure that not just living a good, healthy lifestyle, but if you have something like high blood pressure or high cholesterol or diabetes, you better get your blood sugars in check. You better get your blood pressure down because people, for example, that have diabetes are at twice the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease as a general population. And I think, you know, we've made a lot of progress in Alzheimer's disease. We have a long way to go, but I'm hopeful that in about another 10 or 12 years or so, this is going to be a different disease. We're going to look at it differently. We'll have other different therapeutic avenues out there. And hopefully the more of not just the general population, but also the practitioner population out there will really understand that there's so much that we can do to fight this condition.
One last question. Have you found that when you put your Alzheimer's patients on a good dietary program, good nutritional support, that they actually can improve?
Sure, yeah, we have data to support this. We have a whole nutritional database and a whole, you know, we just presented some of our research at the Clinical Trials in Alzheimer's meeting in Monte Carlo. You know, I can quote a couple of really cool studies. One with the most mild patients, mild cognitive impairment, Dr. Krikorian and colleagues up at the University of Cincinnati, all he did was he put patients on a very low carbohydrate diet, and within, you know, weeks, a matter of weeks, these patients not only improved their memory, they also improved their blood sugar levels, their waist circumference decreased, and their insulin resistance actually improved as well. Insulin resistance is basically your body's ability to use insulin so you don't need to secrete as much of it. That means less insulin equals less inflammation in the brain. Another really great study, Suzanne Kraft and colleagues up at the University of Washington put people on the Western, typical Western diet, like we all, like not like I used to eat, not anymore, like most people in the United States eat, versus kind of that was called the high diet, high in the bad saturated fat, high in the bad carbohydrate, versus the low diet, meaning healthy saturated, you know, the healthy fats, the low carbohydrates, low glycemic index carbohydrates. And when you randomize patients, after 4 weeks, you were able to see improvements in memory. So I think that patients that already have memory loss, as well as for those who are at risk, both, we have pretty definitive evidence, not just in my own research studies and my own research databases, but we've truly shown in a variety of studies that you can change what you eat tomorrow or even today and really have a positive impact on your memory for years to come.
You know, that's so exciting as well as so empowering, because when we know that we actually can do things to improve the function of our brain or any part of our body, we feel that we actually are more in charge and control. And the worst thing is to feel helpless about a situation.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely, you know, people used to say, oh, Alzheimer's, you can't do anything. Well, when I was in high school, you know what, there wasn't really much that was proven, or there was nothing that you could do. You know, in 2013 and beyond, there are so many things. I mean, there's every patient should feel empowered to get educated, get informed, to make a positive impact on their brain and also their bodies.
And that takes us back to your book, which is The Alzheimer's Diet, A Step-by-Step Nutritional Approach for Memory Loss Prevention and Treatment. In your book, you really put together some really practical steps, everything from how to monitor what's going on, how to journal, to the kinds of foods and how to prepare them. You put together a really hands-on, practical approach so people can be proactive, which is wonderful. So let's get people to your website. What's the best website to send them to?
Sure. So you can go to basically a simple thealzheimersdiet.com. That'll take you to a nice overview about the book. We also have a blog on there that people are welcome to read. Learn about a nice overview about different types of foods to eat. If you go to just alzheimersdiet.com, that'll also give you another set of information and things to read. And I think anyone can really use this types of information. We try to keep it nice and simple. You know, the top 10 brain healthy foods, the top send least brain healthy foods, and we give sample recipes and sample meal plans. And what we really try to do is, you know, I work in an academic setting. I'm teaching medical students and physicians and, you know, lecturing at conferences. What we try to do is basically, you know, take that lecture and basically make it for, you know, everyone to be able to understand and implement. And basically, we put people on a 9-week diet plan. And you can go to, you know, www.thealzheimersdiet.com and read all about it.
And I really want to congratulate you on making it really user-friendly so the lay person can really understand it and follow it and get results. So I think that's wonderful. It's a wonderful accomplishment, and congratulations on a very important book.
Great. Well, I really appreciate it, and thank you so much for spreading the word that really, just like we said before, anyone can make a positive impact on their brain, really starting at their next meal, and I think that's really exciting for everybody.
It is exciting, and I want to thank you, Dr. Richard Isaacson, for being such a wonderful guest on the show today.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Selman. An absolute pleasure, and I look forward to speaking at some point in the future as well.
Absolutely. And to all my listeners, thank you for joining me today for another great opportunity to get empowered with truthful information so you can make a big difference in your life and the lives of those that you love. And remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.